I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In November of 1999, Jose Vasquez was shot from point-blank range by a rival gang member, 6 bullets. He says, at the time, I knew that something like that could happen to me, but I didn't care. It was just another scar. Now, Jose is the street outreach worker for the Clark Square Neighborhood Initiative. It's a nonprofit organization on the south side of Milwaukee. He's also a facilitator of Straight Up, an after-school program at South Division High School that teaches young people life skills and leadership. He has been a youth development specialist at United Community Center to run Life Changers, a mentoring program that promotes anti-drug and anti-violence strategies for young adults. Jose is our guest this hour in our downtown Milwaukee studios, and we'll be talking about his life and how it is we stop the violence and give people a sense of hope and a life that's meaningful. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at @KDunn Show. Jose, thanks so much for being with us in our studios today. Hi.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
So in 1999, you were a teenager. You were a member of a gang?
Yes, I was 17 at the time.
What kind of gang?
I really don't like to specifically talk about it due to the fact that in the process of changing my life, one of the things I desired to do was not glorify what I used to be.
Right.
And not give it onus over my life. I acknowledge that I was affiliated and involved in a gang, but as far as, you know, the title,
not the title, but just the reasons, because there have been articles written about you and other young people who have decided to go to gangs because it's a sense of family, which is more what I'm getting at. That home life was rougher for you, I've read about you, and
yes.
So gangs gave you something, you know, that felt more like people cared about each other? Is that
Yeah,
fair?
I think what it is, at that particular time in my life, I didn't know what love was as an experience.
Uh-huh.
You know, there was a lot of little shaky ground as far as the stability and foundation in my life. The neighborhood I grew up in, the friends that I had in that neighborhood, that over time, they transitioned from friends to family to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I responded different to them. And I treated them like family. And because of that, I was kind of committed and loyal to them to be family. And my birth family kind of took secondary because of some of the things I was going through with my upbringing,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of the dysfunctions and trials and things I had to experience. So
mm-hmm.
it was easier for me and it was more safe for me to be on the streets where I was creating my own safety by kind of my own, you know, the environment and my friends versus being at home where I didn't feel safe, not necessarily because of who my parents were, but because of what was happening in their own personal lives and how it was affecting my life.
So when you were doing outreach work and talking to young people and seeing perhaps a version of yourself, your younger self, when you're talking to these young people, you're seeing similar family circumstances that are motivating them to be with each other?
Yeah, I think I see it a lot. One of the things that is kind of misunderstood is that a lot of people say that it's because of this disadvantage or that disadvantage that we all, guys, youth in general, or youth America in general, are enticed by the streets.
Mm-hmm.
When it's not really that, it's more about what is there that we hide that motivates us and puts us together. You know, a lot of us have different backgrounds, a lot of different family dynamics, but there's hurt, there's pain, there's rejection, you know, there's fear. And there's outcast, you know, some of them don't know what healthy love is, what healthy family is.
Mm-hmm.
So they only naturally go to what they know, and that's most of the time the streets. And
mm-hmm.
When I see them, I see myself, you know. But it's a lot more, I think the pressure of survival is a lot more now because of how crime has escalated from when I was growing up, you know. Crime is still crime. I mean, it's still vivid. It's out there. But this generation goes through a little more pressure because social media's got more access to people's lives, because people want to put everything on Twitter or Facebook or, you know, and they want to put everything out there, and they kind of glamorize that life and it becomes them, you know. So it's hard. It's hard when you talk to a young man because they, or a young woman, they sometimes feel judged because how they're living right now. And going back to my life as a youth, that's how I felt. So that's the common ground, you know. And the difference for me is that while I don't condone certain things that they're doing in their own personal lives, I don't condemn it either, because I understand it.
Right.
And because I understand it, I know that they can be loved despite, you know, the misunderstanding that a lot of people have.
So the area, the Clark Square neighborhood area, had a pretty rough year last year.
Yeah, very. Car thefts, shootings, a lot of different domestic, just a lot of different, and it's segregated pockets of crime, but it was consistent.
Mm-hmm. So you walk through the streets, you're an outreach worker,
Yes.
walk through the streets and you just talk to people?
Majority of the time, I'm not agenda driven unless I have to commit a project. You know, if I'm working with somebody and say, for instance, they want to do some work in the community, and I'll help them, and I'll go out there and I'll help them. But majority of the time, it's free. You know, it's out of my own, me getting up and saying, you know what, I'm just going to go walk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just going to go find out. Or if I hear that, hey, there's a lot of violence going on over here, you know, or these young men over here are getting in trouble with law, you know, I'll try to go out and talk to them and see what's going on, to get the feel from not of a reporter standpoint where I'm going to go run and tell this,
right,
what's going on, but from a standpoint of how can I get your trust to help you see there's more options out here,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a lot of the people in the community, they're open to share their problems. They just don't sometimes like who has the solutions to their problems, because they don't want to get involved in certain programs. They don't want to get involved in organizations. You know, they kind of want a freelance life. You know, but they have problems that they need resources for. You know, so it all depends on what one day can give.
So what are the options for them, Jose?
For a lot of the like for employment, there's a lot of different. One of the things I try to do for. Okay, I'll scope it down to audience. For the youth, I try to get them in some type of job preparation. If they're able to start working, you know, I try to help them along with, let's get you a job permit. You know, let's get in there and talk to your school counselor. Let's try to get you situated where you can earn that privilege. You know, the next step is, you know, what do you do from there? Then there's also stuff like simple things like housing resources. You know, they need to know if they can go and their family can find a place to live, and they have a kind of shaky history with maybe evictions,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, and evictions may be something that wasn't their fault necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, I had a family, they just co-rented with somebody, that person broke their lease and they weren't able to meet it, you know, and that happened at 5-6 years ago. They still have to deal with the consequences of that, you know, but in a community where you're trying to build trust and build relationships, you want to present an option to help them people deal with that, because that's a real life issue. You know, people having evictions and people having these things, they're going to get denied. They're going to get, you know, so
right.
If you want to really be effective, you want to kind of trying to have a solution to help them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's a lot of that is dealing with some partnerships through local ministries and stuff that have connections with rental agencies that would be willing to work with people with such a past, you know, so it makes it a little more easier for their own transition,
mm-hmm.
and it also is a kind of a staple of community working together and coming together and serving the people, which is the greater purpose that we do in a community. It's not about us, it's supposed to be for the community.
And housing is a huge issue, isn't it, that we tend to overlook. It's big.
Yeah, it's big as far, even living conditions is big. I'm pretty sure because of policies, they can't release nuisance reports to just anybody, but I'm pretty sure from a MPD, Milwaukee Police Department position, they know these nuisance houses, and it makes it harder on the owners of these houses, makes it harder on the tenants of these houses, because it changed the whole landscape of the environment. If you're going to live in a neighborhood where down the block there's a known, maybe a known drug house, a known prostitute house, it makes you question the quality of life you have and where you want to raise your kids. You don't want your kids to see this, but then you know you can only fight so much, you know, and then you may have a young single mother who is just starting off and never had a place to live, you know, and may not even have a good, let's just be honest, good credit score or work history even to qualify for some of these apartments. So to be able to have some flexibility with working with these real estate agencies, it helps us because you kind of mediate. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of say, well, hey, you know, this person, the reason why we're standing up for this person, not only because we believe in them having the opportunity for a stable life, but they're also doing A, B, and C to prove that this is really what they want. You know, and when a person has kind of done the work to prove that this is what they want, we should be in a position to help them and not kind of create more obstacles because there's not options out here. You know, we should try to find them. And I'm pretty sure whether it's through the federal government or it's through local nonprofit or churches, there's resources, but these people in the community don't have access to them. They're not willing or don't even know where to begin to find the information.
Right. Yeah. That's the big help thing. Them with that. There was an article about you in Neighborhood News a while ago that talked, and it must have been a dramatic day for you, that talked about you going to the house where you were shot in 1999. You hadn't been there in years. And you knocked on the door, and the neighbor remembered you being shot and asked, you were asking for help to, you know, try to make the neighborhood a better place.
Yeah. It was big for me. I was asked to do it, and I felt it as if a challenge for me. Not a challenge as for I can't do it, but a challenge as if I can present this own form of reconciliation and accountability on my own life for how I used to live. You know, whether he was willing to accept my apology, extend forgiveness, I wasn't responsible for that. You know, I was just responsible for saying, you know what, there was a particular time in my life where this is what I thought was right.
Mm-hmm.
I can't change that, but I can tell you that I do recognize the wrong in that, and this is what I've done to, in a sense, correct that, but not where I'm correcting it, where I'm trying to prove to everybody that this is the new me, but I'm doing it from a standpoint of, this is me and this is who I'm going to be, and I'm not doing this because I want recognition.
Right.
You know, I really wanted to sit down and talk with this man, and we had a real good conversation. He remembered it very vividly. He actually he was renting it to the tenants at that time, so he knew about it. He was able to even point me to the bullet holes in the house.
Gosh.
And at that very moment, I got to feel how he felt for his property. And he had spent over 30-some years living there. And to see his neighborhood go through that transition was big for him. But it actually allowed me to see that though I wasn't intentionally trying to make him a victim of the lifestyle I was living, I did, because while he didn't get hurt, his property was damaged, which cost him, you know, which took money out of his family, out of what he was doing with his life. So in a sense, I owed him an apology, you know. And I got to talk with him, and I asked him, I said, you know, is there a way that you would be willing and wanting to fight back for your community, you know? And he said, it's unattainable is what he said. And I said, you know what, in so many circles it is, because there's so many barriers that people have confronted and let stay there because there's a policy there, because there's a funder they may pull out if you contest. You know, there's real life things going on. And I just felt like, you know what, if you really want to fight for your community, you're going to fight. Whether you have allies or you don't, you're going to find a way to make your voice be heard. You know, and he felt voiceless.
Yeah. You know, sitting here across from you, you're such a wise, gentle young man. It's hard to believe that you were in the circumstances that you were in. And people must be struck when they hear about your life by who you are now. And I guess my question is, that was in you all along, obviously. People don't just totally change overnight. So where did you discover this part of you which is so dominant right now?
I think my changing, the actual changing point in my life came where I realized that my life really wasn't my own, that I was being selfish, you know. And I had a good friend of mine. He had changed his life through his relationship with God. And while I've never, growing up, never been opposed to God, nor did I ever live where I acknowledged him either. You know, it wasn't one of those things either. I could be honest with that. But it started to change over life, and I started to see how his relationship with God changed how he's seen life. And then I started to see in my own self how I had been allowed to go through so much different stuff that some people lose their lives for. You know, I've had friends who have lost their lives, you know, and I have had and of countless stories and experiences. And for me to come up out of that isn't nothing of myself, you know, because the way that I lived and the way that I seen life that particular day in November 99 should have been the last day I was here. If you look at how I lived, but it is only by the grace of God that I am here today. But I'm more responsible for my life today in a sense that what I'm doing with it, because I know what I didn't do with it for so long. And I can never repay those people that maybe directly or indirectly were hurt by how I lived. I just can only accept responsibility for it and allow how I'm living today to show. And most people say, man, you know, we wouldn't have thought you lived like that, and we didn't think you lived like that. And I said, you know, that's where you have to just take a moment to yourself and kind of, me, I would thank God, but some people may not see it like that. But I would just be happy and content that what I've been through, I don't look like, and it didn't take me up.
Yeah. So when you talk to students in high school and when you talk to young people you meet on the street, do you reveal that part of you? Does it stop? I would imagine that what you have to say is pretty compelling. It's not, you can't walk away from what you have to say. You must reach a lot of people. Do you open up about that so people can see a different way and you describe it? Or
I want to, one of the things I want to do and for the rest of my life is continue to expose the lies that young men and women face in the community, the younger generation. There are a lot of social lies that they face, you know.
What are those?
Some of them, you got the stereotype, because you're from the hood, you never get out the hood. Because you're fatherless, you'll never become a good father. You know, because your mother is on welfare, you'll know nothing but welfare. You know, because your family is dysfunctional, you'll never break that curse of dysfunctional. You know, you'll just continue the cycle, and you just continue bringing a lesser value to life, you know. And that's how a lot of people think. You know, a lot of people actually, they have those fears. And some people wouldn't think like that and wouldn't even put their mind around stuff like that. But people, you know, they do. And a lot of young men, one of the things that really helps me when I talk to the youth is I try not to forget where I came from. But I'm open where I've been, but not to the point where I'm being, how can I put this?
Preachy about it?
I'm not trying to preach to them as I am trying to just get them to see, you know. And how I do that is I share my testimony, but one of the things I do is I always have some kind of article. One of my hobbies that I do is I go to the public library and I go to the archives and I dig up articles. Last month, my article was based on a young man. This was in 96. He was a young man out of Wauwatosa. He was Foonsped. The article was Golden Spoon. You know, he was influenced by the streets, and that played a role, and he became active participant in the murder. Oh. And him and his family and the community in all, they couldn't understand how somebody who had this dynamic family support system could fall to the streets. Mm-hmm. You know, and I believe it was Professor of Sociology, I think his name's Elijah Anderson, he's from Yale. He had talked about the quicksand of the streets, you know, but knowing the streets and living the streets, I understand that there are quicksands to the streets, but the streets have an influence to sway you to their desire, you know, and they just, for me growing up in the gang culture, some of the gang members would feed off those vulnerabilities that I had in my own self, you know. I didn't have a father figure, so there was some who stepped up to be that father figure because they seen that desire within me to see that met. Mm-hmm. So they knew that if I had that desire, I would do anything for that to be met. Mm-hmm. And then, therefore, from there, they would end up, in some cases, I'm not ashamed to say it, I was manipulated, mm-hmm. you know, to believe in stuff. But then I still, by my own admission, did it, you know, mm-hmm. because I believed it to be truth.
Do we need, it's been a constant interest of mine to see young people who come from the most miserable of circumstances and who had lives, you know, like yours, or certainly family members, who have been able to get out of it, you know, even though, I mean, they don't believe the myth of the streets, as you said, but they've gone on to really build these huge, substantial lives. And I always wonder, why is it you who can do that and not others who can do that? And I sometimes think it's, you know, a teacher, it's a mentor, it's somebody who just won't let you fall, somebody who's just there for you and helps you to see what it is you can do. And it's true, I think, for all of us in our lives, that we all have people like that who have said, you've got this talent, and I'm not going to let you go. I want you to identify it in yourself, and I want you to be able to blossom. Is that what we need? Did you have somebody like that? Does it take somebody who will really support you?
Yeah, it does. It actually takes... It actually takes wise, supportive counsel, you know, because for me, I've had the privilege to have had a mentor and built some mentor relationships with older people in the community as mm-hmm. far as for, you know, they've been there. They got 27, 30 years of doing this. So for me, it's nothing to want to sit under them and just learn some of the lessons that they learned and even learn from some of even the mistakes they made. You know, but for me, I think what I believe will keep a person's vision not just alive in themselves but believable within themselves is somebody who's willing to take that risk and say, you know what, I believe in what you're doing.
Right.
You know, and that's powerful because it's the same ingredient needed from when you're on the opposite side as well. You know, me growing up, I needed the gang to believe that I could be the best.
Yeah, interesting.
And they fed that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the turn on this is that I don't need to prove nothing. They just see that this is in me. You know, I use the kind of handed down, I want to say, lesson that I was given by my mentor, and that is that, you know, your mess is kind of your ministry. You don't know that. Nobody knows your mess better than you.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows what I've been through better than me. And what does that give me? That gives me, it gives me a platform to relate. But because of my own compassion and because of my beliefs, I can kind of love that too. You know, and it helps me. So for somebody, for myself, when I have those times, I can give a call to a couple of people that I've done a lot of work with. I have a lot of different organizations, you know, Safe and Sound, you know, Southside Community Organizations, people that I have worked with and still work with to this day that have their own way of holding me accountable and they don't know it. But it's gotten to a point in my life because people have nurtured that in me that I don't see me doing this as having an end because I see it as a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe your purpose has an end until, you know, it's reached its season.
Yeah.
you know.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them in a moment. Our guest this hour is Jose Vasquez, and he came to our attention from an interesting piece that we read about him in a Milwaukee newspaper. He is a street outreach worker for the Clark Square Neighborhood Initiative. He describes some of his past. He obviously has moved way beyond that. He is also now... Well, and Clark Square is a nonprofit organization on the south side of Milwaukee. He's also a facilitator of Straight Up, which is an after-school program at South Division High School. He teaches young people life skills and leadership, and he has worked as a youth development specialist at United Community Center to run Life Changers, which is a mentoring program that promotes anti-drug and anti-violent strategies for young adults. Here is our phone number. If you would like to join our conversation, we'd like to hear from you. It's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Many of them are coming in for Jose, and we start with Pam in Madison. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I wanted to ask Jose if he remembered a moment when he realized he was a person in and of himself, and if so, when that happened and how it felt.
I think, thank you for the question, Pam. I think that I get small glimpses of that in my life as my life goes. I don't think I completely came, you know, to myself. From a standpoint of change, I would say yes, and it was when I was doing some outreach work and I came across some of my old friends. So I was able to share where I was at in my life, not be offended by it, and walk away knowing that not only did I put a milestone for me in being able to walk away from that life, but I wasn't ashamed of where I was at either and what I was doing. I think that was really when I knew that I could go face whatever I needed to face, because I was willing to face it within myself first.
So how were you treated by those old friends?
To be honest with you, nothing but, in a sense, in the weirdest way, it's just a mutual respect because of how I lived that life and the commitment I had to it, but a respect because of what I'm doing now.
Really?
And how, you know, one of the things I stay away from is I stay away from judging and bashing that the young men and women caught in that lifestyle because they get it from so many places. I'm not an advocate of what they're doing at all. You know, I can say that, but I think that you can see that so much that there's not an avenue for you to love them if you're looking at everything you don't like about them. You know.
Thank you, Pam, for your call. Mike in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How you doing, Kathleen? Great show today.
Thanks,
I wanted
Mike.
To tell Jose that he is probably one of the best speakers I've ever heard on your show. He exemplifies the future of Milwaukee if this city is going to thrive and grow. I wanted to tell him that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm a retired firefighter, Mike, or Jose, and I've been all over the city of Milwaukee. And unfortunately, in my case, I have two very successful children, and I have one child who is a heroin addict. In fact, he is in detox right as we speak. And for over a year, my wife and I have been trying to help him to battle this desire to go from very middle-class, good family to the streets. And we're having a very hard time reaching him. Do you have any words of wisdom, possibly for me and my wife as parents, in this situation to maybe turn him back away from this lifestyle that he's now chosen?
I think the best thing you can do is continue to show him the vision you have for him when it comes to father and son relationship. Whatever has pushed him in the streets, it's not the streets that is keeping him there. It's the fear of letting go of the streets and facing what he needs to face to move on with his life that is holding him back. And the number one person that a person rejects the most in the streets is the people who care, you know. And it's not because they don't know they care. In fact, they know they do care. It's just they want a moment in their life where they don't want nobody to care so they can have that time to do what they think is right, you know, because they want to. For instance, I use an example of myself. I'll just speak of myself. I can relate to that because there were times where family members of mine just wanted me to come home, just wanted me to be home. You don't need to be living out in the streets. You don't need to be living like this. And I'm pretty sure for yourself, Mike, you've sacrificed a lot to give him a different quality of life. And yeah. In the neighborhood, in the urban hood neighborhood, a lot of parents don't do that, you know. And kids, why are kids willing to give that up? It's because, you know, they're entertained by what's going on in their life. You know, they want this this thrill, this excitement.
The thrill.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of what's happening with our son.
Yeah,
the edge. He told me that.
Yeah, it's because what it is it brings a different type of excitement to life, and that is how far can you play with danger, you know? And mm-hmm. And there's an excitement in that, whether you know people want to admit it or not. There's an excitement because a lot of people live off of that, and some people they try to find their way around that, you know, and they don't know how to basically maybe use a different outlet to express that. But when you meet the thrill of the streets, it can be enticing, you know, and it can it can be challenging because the streets will, if a person is addicted to something, the streets will abuse that person because they don't see him as a people. They're just going to they're going to help him support his habit, you know, and they don't care what he did to get that. They don't care about the bridges he burnt. They don't care about any of that, you know. And one of the things I see in that whole problem is that you got one person battling, saying, we don't care. Then you got this young man in the middle, and then you got his family saying, you know, I love him and I care for him, and we're trying to do everything possible. The thing that I believe can happen to him would be a changed life. You know, if there's a way to prepare an intervention for not just him, but where he's at. You know, he may not be ready for a direct intervention, but if you targeted the neighborhood he's at, the people he's hanging out with, and you targeted them as a whole, there's no room for opportunity for him to get offended because we've offended everybody. You know, one of the things I've always said is if you want to deal with the problem, you got young guys on the street causing nuisance, you go to them. You know, you don't just go to the one you know is doing it. If there's five on the porch, you know, there's mm-hmm. one on the porch that's doing it, you go to all of them.
Right.
You know, and it works. And I think for you, I think that if you continue to support and love him from a standpoint where you don't condone what he's doing, but you love him enough to say, you know what, I love you through the transition from this, you know, because I love you to know that this ain't you. So I can hold your hand, you know, without hurting myself or my, you know, for your instance, for you or your wife, you know, because I'm sure it's dragging you both down. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a matter of how I can love you. I will love you how you let me love you. But at the same time, you know, he has to know that resounding message that, hey, I'm not giving up on you. You know,
yeah, we are looking to make a miracle out of the mess.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is what I believe. I believe this will happen. It's just, it's a lot of work, and he's fighting us right now. But I have him in a good place today, and I look at today is mm-hmm. a better day than yesterday.
You know, when one of my things I wanted to share with you is that I learned this about 4 years ago. I met a pastor he came up to Milwaukee, came out of Kentucky, and he said the most profound thing. He said that when a person has a purpose, there isn't any devil in hell that wouldn't go after that person not wanting to live his purpose. You know, so right now, he's being attacked for how his life isn't in the right place, maybe where you necessarily know he has the potential to take it. It's just that I think he has to be leaving himself again to be able to see that this is who he is and be able to forgive himself for what he's been through and what he put other people through so that he can fully be healed from that. And in the process of changing his life, he won't have no regrets that'll interfere with, you know, him enjoying his new life, you know, because I think, like, if you haven't made that, you'll kind of hold that over, you know. And there's going to be, you know, there's going to be a point where I'm pretty sure that in change you have to be accountable, you know. So he will have to be accountable to you and your wife. And I think because of the love that you have for him and the measure of love you extend to him, I think it'll be a lot easier for him in the transition. And it'll be a lot more rewarding for you guys because it's you won't be doing anything that you don't normally do, and that's just love him. You know, it's just him coming to grips that, hey, my parents really care about me, you know?
It must be so hard for you, though, Mike. Oh, my gosh, I can only imagine. It must be hard.
You have to have an iron will, Kathleen. Right. You cannot give up. As parents that are listening to me that have kids on drugs, which is we're just getting started with this, unfortunately, in this city and in this country because of just the acceptance of all narcotics as a way of life. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate. It's the way we're going. But we need to turn the tide. And I'm praying that my son becomes the leadership on the other side,
right,
the way that Jose is the leadership in the future of the city,
right,
coming through and having been there. And that is, it's the only way it's going to work. Mm-hmm. We have to work within our communities, within our various ethnic and socioeconomic groups, and say, hey, we are the leaders, and we're going to change, because otherwise it's not going to happen.
Right.
So I applaud you, Jose, and I thank you for everything you said to me.
Thank you very much, Mike, and I'll be praying for you and your family and your son.
Thank you, sir. I greatly appreciate it, and thank you, Kathleen, for your show. It's awesome.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for calling in.
Yep.
Oh, I want to take a deep breath after that one. A lot of people going through similar things.
Yeah.
Wayne in Marshfield, hi.
Yeah, hi. Back again. Thanks, Jose, for your work there. It's thrilling to hear about that, and I suspect the Milwaukee area could use a dozen of you spread around the city. And my question is, how much does funding hold you back? I think it would be wonderful if even tax money or nonprofit money, if you had $50,000 discretionary, that you did not have to make a lot of paperwork to justify. You could pay a security deposit to get somebody in some stable housing. You could pay the fee for somebody to join a sports team. And just, it's endless what I suspect you could do if you could just reach in your pocket and grease the wheels.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that is one of the, I won't say biggest challenges I face, because one of the things I am a firm believer of is that if you are doing what is right, it will produce itself. One of the things I try to stay away from is all the politics that are connected with funding. And I realize that some people, because of funding, you know, they're limited. Me, myself, if there was a different source of funding that would believe in, you know, what we're doing as a whole, it would benefit us as far as, like you said, helping those people, you know. And it's not, okay, they've given us money, so we're just going to give you money. No, it has nothing to do like that. What it is how can we be the best stewards of this, and how can we be the most effective with what we have to kind of multiply that and hopefully monopolize that bigger? You know, sometimes, like right now, we may not have the money to put up a person who has a bad past with evictions. But one of the things I try to do is I try to find somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who can give this person a direction that isn't going to cause them to give up on what they want to have, you know, because sometimes there's so many loopholes and so many paperwork and stuff that has to be, you know. It would be nice to be able to have a four family, five family complex that we had at disposal.
Yes,
to be able to help these people through a certain period of transition. Mm-hmm. Of course, it would probably be limited with, you know, your budget plan and your financial planning that you would set them up with, and they would definitely have to be out in a certain time so that you can keep the program being effective. I would love for something like that. Now, the thing that would make something like that happen is kind of a heart-to-heart with somebody who believes in that purpose happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then not only that, but from my standpoint, it would be a don't hold me accountable. Listen to the people who are holding me accountable, and you hear from them whether you want to trust what we're doing.
Right.
Because I believe accountability is important. You know, you don't want to necessarily get caught up in you got the own ownership of what this is. You know, these are viable partners in this. You know, we all have a say because we're all working together. You may, you know, the funders of programs, they may not be on the front line, but one of the things they do, they may have the shoelaces that tie your shoes to get you on the front line and keep you on the front line.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many issues here, but I think you're spot on, Wayne, with a discretionary fund like that, that evicted show that we did that's receiving so much attention. People wind up in homeless shelters, you know,
Taxes. I mean, I just cringe when people try to avoid to pay the least amount of taxes. I think, funding is so important, and the kind of work that's being accomplished, you can't always measure.
Right.
I completely agree.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Again.
Thanks, Wayne, for the call. Our number, we have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation with Jose, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Let's go back to drugs for a moment, because I know you have worked with young people on this particular issue, and I'm wondering how widespread drug problems are in the community where you are and how in the world you address it.
I mean, it's actually become the norm that the abnormal right now is when it's in or outside of the city of Milwaukee lines. You know, then it becomes, oh, what is it doing out here? You know, then it like, for instance, for the neighbors out in Sussex and maybe Grafton, you know, they deal with it on a different scale. But the same drug that is being used out there is being used in the city.
Mm-hmm.
If you go through the city, you'll see the consequences more rapid. But I think for the drug problem here is it isn't necessarily the government or their approach to try to be anti-drugs. It's just that you're dealing with a cycle of that has perpetuated itself, and that is the criminal enterprise. You know, they're never going to stop doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
They're going to always find a way to manipulate their lifestyle and doing what they do. And you can kick them out of one neighborhood and they'll just displace to another neighborhood. That's the common theme with every form of crime. It's just how it rolls. But I think with the drugs, you're seeing a more impact in how it's affecting the kids in school. One of the things I've noticed is that with the kids I'm dealing with at South Division in particular, I get an opportunity to see their attendance, and I get an opportunity to see their behavior, you know, what they're doing. And I get behavior reports on kids, you know, kids that I want to participate in the group and kids that are participating. You know, I work really well with the violence-free zone facilitators that are there at South Division. And so I have an idea of who they consider at risk. However, I like to work with the high risk because, you know, high risk for me, it means that when you're at risk, that means you're almost there. When you're high risk, you're there.
Right.
You know, so I like to work with them are there because I know how to deal with them too.
Yeah.
All stages of it, but I think you're seeing it a lot more in kids. They're skipping school to get high, or they're coming to school high, or they're witnessing it at home, they're selling it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see it, so it's messing with their future from a standpoint of if you mess up at NPS, you get kicked out, you got to go to alternative. And yeah, they have good alternative schools in the city. I'm not trying to say that, but I'm just saying the setback that it causes.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Let's welcome our phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Jose Vasquez is our guest this hour. He's been doing some really extraordinary outreach work in Milwaukee. He is now a street outreach worker for the Clark Square Neighborhood Initiative. It's on Milwaukee's south side. It is a nonprofit organization and a facilitator of Straight Up, an after-school program at South Division High School teaching young people skills and leadership. So we'll go back to, we'll take as many calls as we can. We're running short on time, but we'll get to you. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls again. Richard in River Falls. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Jose, thank you for being on this program. I tell you, you sound like a real breath of fresh air. Anyway, in this world that we have today. And a couple of comments on a couple of the other callers. And this one gal called in. She said, "How did you find your inner self?" And I think you knew what she meant. And I think it's a fact that when you found your inner self, that's when you could turn yourself around, and only from the outside. And that's with the help of the Lord. I think that's probably right. I'm not positive. I'll wait for you to give a comment off the air. And the other thing is that stay away from government money. That one fella had he had a good heart there probably, but once you start taking federal money or tax money to do any kind of outreach that has anything to do with people finding the Lord, they'll shut you down pretty quick. So just keep doing what you're doing. It sounds wonderful.
I think you got to take money from wherever you can get it to do the kind of outreach work that Jose is doing. I don't care where. If you got money to help people with housing, take the money, right? Jose, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I do agree with you. My personal change came from my relationship with the Lord. I don't shy away from it. However, I use it in a pedestal for integrity, and not to bash or kind of shun what other people believe. Because in what my relationship, I believe that love is what it costs for me to have that relationship with God, because he loved us and loved his son, and that's why I have that opportunity, not because of anything I've done myself. So my change is not anything about me. I don't like to glorify a changed life or my changed life. The reason why I do not is because it's not about my testimony is not about where I've been and how I've changed and what I'm doing, but it's more so about him who allowed me to have that opportunity and what I'm going to do with that opportunity, and for the funding, to some degree there are aspects where you are right, you don't want to get caught up in that, but when you're dealing with the whole aspect of outreach, you don't want to get yourself caught up in somebody else's strings. But if somebody else is willing to help you and there's no strings attached, then it's kind of your responsibility to say, hey, you know what? I don't need this help for me. I need it for somebody else. I won't compromise my integrity. But at the same time, if you're willing to help under these guidelines, then, hey, let's help these people, let's not let that be the red flag or the street we won't cross because we don't like how the concrete looks,
Yeah, it's well put. One more call. We have about a minute left. Steve in Burlington. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Steve.
I want to thank you for having this gentleman on. 50 years ago, I lived in the neighborhood he's talking about and was forced into a gang. I unfortunately left that neighborhood when I was very young and became successful out in the open world. But you carry that neighborhood with you wherever you go. And it's a hard battle to continually fight that.
Yeah, you are right. Because I'm a firm believer that wherever your heart is at, throughout the course of your day and throughout the period of your life, your attention is going to be there, And for you growing up in the neighborhood, I would suspect you have a heart for the neighborhood, the condition in the neighborhood. You know a little bit about what took you to want to join that gang. You know about the pressures and things going on. And in order to be effective in a community, you need people like who know where they came from and also know what the people who are still there facing, and you're willing to want to help,
And on that note, we say goodbye. Jose, thank you so much for being with us. Really, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Jose Vasquez, he is a street outreach worker for the Clark Square Neighborhood Initiative on the south side of Milwaukee. It's a nonprofit organization. He's also facilitator of Straight Up, after-school program at South Division High School. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Kendra Smith, whose picture is on our Facebook page. Actually, Jose's is on our Facebook page now, too. So two people worth looking at on the Kathleen Dent Show. Thanks. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.